my plan is to return to the Obamanator's failed policy regarding Syria and the Islamic State, but I do have to comment on Hegel's stupidity. His answer to revitalize the morale of our nuclear forces is to invest in our nuclear forces. What good can come of investing in our nuclear forces? How do you tell Iran you can't have a singular nuclear bomb when America is going to invest in its nuclear forces? What can our nuclear force do for us? Is that, do you think that if we didn't have nuclear weapons that Russia would decide that it's in their interest to nuke us? Do you think that the Chinese would decide that, you know, if America couldn't retaliate, what we're going to do is we're going to blow up our largest economic market? We're just going to destroy our customer. And by the way, we already own huge amounts of America. We're going to go ahead and destroy what we own. Do you think that if America gave up, just completely did away with its nuclear arsenal, that the French or the British would launch a nuclear strike against us? Do you think there's any possibility that our nuclear arsenal is actually preventing war? Or do you think that when you have morons like the Obamanator as President of the United States, men who are thoroughly and completely disingenuous, who are wholly and completely immoral, that such men can be trusted never to deploy those nuclear weapons? And if the only hope is that you can trust your lying presidents to never deploy the nuclear weapons, recognizing if they do deploy them, the retribution on the country would be devastating. The country would be completely obliterated. If your best hope is that they never use them, then why do you have them? Isn't the greatest assurance that they never use them is not to have them? What moral, rational argument can be made today for revitalizing nuclear forces? It's time we face reality. We need to destroy them. Now, I don't have a problem taking the, you know, 90% fissile purity of uranium and plutonium and downgrading it so that it can power nuclear power plants and build nuclear power plants aplenty and generate electricity so that we don't have to import so much oil from those who are trying to kill us. But there's no value whatsoever in the bombs. None. Wake up, America. You know, your military is counterproductive. It's expensive, and every time it's deployed, it makes a situation worse, and nothing could be as germane to that argument as America's nuclear forces. They provide absolutely no benefit, and they are a tremendous liability. I'm going to continue now with Syria. The Obamanator asked Congress for $500 million to train and equip 5,000 vetted rebels within 1 year. That was many months ago. And yet administration officials are now saying it is perfectly clear, and has been for some time, that the notion of supporting the moderate oppositions in hopes of toppling Assad isn't going to work. A senior administration official told CNN. I can do the math. We did it on this program. Your entire pool of potential moderate to take on Assad is in the range of 3,000 to 5,000. That's the pool out of the entire country is 3,000 to 5,000. And they wouldn't survive a day. Not one day. It wouldn't survive a day if America provided air cover for them, if America trained them and equipped them and gave them the fanciest of all weapons. They wouldn't survive a day. You know, one of the problems here is that if you were to take a poll of Syrians, the overwhelming preponderance of Syrians hate America. The last thing a Syrian wants to be seen doing, because it's a death warrant, is fighting on behalf of America. This isn't going to work. It's a pipe dream. And when you engage your military and squander a nation's resources, destroying other countries based upon impossibilities without any chance of success, then you're a menace to the world. That's what America has become, a menace to the world. Many of the president's top national security advisor, including Secretary of State John Kerry, who I despise, have long argued that Washington's political strategy is wholly unrealistic. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel sent a blunt memo to the National Security Advisor, another scumbag, Susan Rice, in October, that was copied and sent to CNN. It expressed concern about the overall Syrian strategy and expressed a fear that the U.S. is risking complete failure in the war against the Islamic State if adjustments aren't made. But there are no adjustments. There's no strategy that will prevail here. We declared war before we thought through the issues. This is a religious civil war. There are no good sides. There are no Democrats here. There's no freedom fighters. There's no political cause. This is a religious civil war between Sunnis and Shias. It's a civil war that's being fought because America invaded Iraq and changed the balance of power between Shia and Sunni. The only thing that would resolve the problem in Syria is to turn back the clock and not invade Iraq. But since that can't be done, this can't be resolved. There are consequences of stupid actions. This article continues by saying the officials in the president's administration have said, we have a need to have a sharper view of what to do about the Assad regime. And that's because we're now attacking as an enemy and bombing the Islamic State, which was the only remaining foe of Assad. So they want Assad gone, but they're bombing the principal Mujahideen in opposition to Assad. Well, that's really stupid. In response to the revelations about the Hagel memo, the White House spokesmen have said that his advisors would be constantly assessing the strategy. They don't have a strategy. Efforts to expand the program to build a Syrian rebel force have been stymied by slow and complicated vetting procedures. They can't vet qualified fighters. More than 4 months after announcing an effort to train and equip the moderate Syrian opposition, of which there is none, Pentagon spokesperson Rear Admiral John Kirby told CNN the vetting process had not even begun. And logistics are still being worked out with the Turks and Saudis who would be hosting the training. The vetting hasn't started. Once it does start, this is the quote, that will be about a 3 to 5 month process, and then it's about 8 to 9 months of training after that. 8 or 9 months of training, and you're going to send civilians with weapon systems to attack the Syrian army, the Syrian Air Force. 3 to 5,000 of them are going against the 200,000 members of the Syrian Army and Air Force, and at least twice to three times that number of Hezbollah fighters who have trained their entire adult life for this. And at the same time, they're going to go up against some 60,000 Mujahideen that are equipped with the best American weapons, all of which they've stolen or been given. And they're going to do so with 8 to 9 months of training. This is what Kirby said in his interview with CNN last week. So we still have a ways to go. A review would come as the military starts meeting with more than 30 countries. The White House is now saying, to, quote, further develop and refine military campaign plans to degrade and defeat the Islamic State, according to the central command. So we've declared war. We're perpetrating that war. And now we're meeting with the 30 countries that signed up to participate in one way or another in that war to refine and develop the campaign strategy. Well, the fact of the matter is that most of the countries that signed on in some tacit way have no interest in what we're doing. Their interest is in toppling Assad because it's a Shia-supported regime. It projects the influence of Iran. They want to topple Assad. And America's fight is against the Islamic State, which is the principal foe of Assad. It doesn't work. This coalition has zero chance of staying together and of being effective. Anyway, this article continues to say, and this is a quote from a White House spokesman. That means that they want to consider a wide range of opportunities to make sure we're doing everything we possibly can to protect and defend American interests around the world. Do you think the Saudis give a crap about American interests? Are the Turks? Are the Qataris? Are the Kuwaitis? Are the Jordanians? Do you think anyone in this coalition gives two hoots about American interests?
With that same thought in mind, do you think America gives two hoots about any of their interests?
Of course not.
Of course not. Why would you?
Why don't you tell me why fighting the Islamic State is in America's interest? Why don't you tell me why toppling Assad is in America's interest? Why don't you tell me how toppling Saddam Hussein was in America's interest? Can you tell me how defending Saudi Arabia and Kuwait was in America's interest? Why was the invasion of Afghanistan in America's interest? Why is providing all of the money to support the military junta in Egypt in America's interest? Why is providing all of the money and the weapons for the Pakistani government in America's interest? How is any of that in America's interest? Many Arab states, you should read, Muslim countries, fiefdoms, have expressed frustration with what they perceive as an ambivalence by the United States toward getting rid of al-Assad. Secretary of State John Kerry and General John Allen, the U.S. envoy to the anti-Islamic State coalition, have reported back to the White House that key allies such as Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Turkey are calling for a framework for a political transition in Syria. But there is no framework for a political transition in Syria. There is a 0% possibility that Assad is going anywhere. If he were to leave, he's going to be tried for war crimes. He'll be convicted for those war crimes. He'll spend the rest of his years in prison. He's not going to give up being king for that. And he knows that if he were to leave Syria, and all of those around him know that if he were to leave Syria, they're dead. So he's got absolutely no one around him encouraging him to leave, all begging him to stay. And he knows that if he does leave, he's going straight to prison. So, why? How would there be a political transition? Now, if you want a military transition, and you say, okay, we're going to bomb him into submission. Well, if the United States wants to bomb Damascus into submission, not only would we kill millions of people, all civilians, actually, but in addition to that, the Russians would intervene. We'd have World War III. That doesn't sound like a very good idea. So the other option is that you arm Sunni Muslims to go take out the Shia government. Well, that's the tactic that we've used for the last 3 years. And it brought us the Islamic State. Now, that's not a very good option, is it? Those are the only options. There are no others. That's the reason why, when it comes to an Islamic country, the best approach is always to stay away. To expose it, to condemn it, to isolate it, to quarantine it. Don't engage. Don't sell them weapons. Don't buy their oil. Stay away. If they wish to kill each other, as they will inevitably do, let them do so on the scale of swords and sticks and stones, rather than 50 caliber machine guns, anti-tank and anti-personnel rounds. Dumb it down. Stay away. There is no framework possible for a political transition in Syria. This quote, what really tripped this into a more vigorous reassessment, this is from the White House, was hearing from our coalition partners that they are not convinced by the Syrian part of this strategy that it has a coherent Syrian peace. I mean, the reason that the Saudi Arabians created the monster of al-Nusra and the Islamic State, along with Qatar and Kuwait and the United Arab Emirates, and to a lesser degree facilitating the jihadists anyway, Turkey. The reason that they all facilitated al-Nusra and the Islamic State was because after America's invasion of Iraq, where Iraq was given to Iran, it changed the balance of power between Shia and Sunni Muslims, where Shia Islam now controlled Syria as well as Iraq, as well as Lebanon. And it put a rift right between the most powerful Sunni Islamic countries, Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states on one side and Turkey on the other. It was devastating for them. They were scared spitless, particularly now that the American invasion had freed Iran to develop nuclear weapons. And so they enabled, they armed, they did their betting to create the Islamic State and to create al-Nusra. Now, it is true that as much as the Saudi Arabians and the Qataris and the Kuwaitis hate the Shiite control through the Assad regime in Syria, they now realize they have built a monster that at any moment will turn on them in the Islamic State. But they went into Syria to, as a religious war, to diminish the influence of Shia Islam. When America put together a coalition to attack the principal club that was being deployed by them to defeat and disable Shia Islam, it's counterproductive to their interests. They have no desire, no motive to participate. We have got ourselves in a pickle. And there are no good answers. In fact, there are no answers, period. Officials and diplomats said Kerry has in recent months intensified discussions with Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates, even with Turkey and, believe it or not, Russia, about the possibility of a diplomatic track to transition al-Assad and his inner circle out of power. Now, how are you going to do that? Why don't you come up with a scenario where it's possible that Assad is going to give up power? And by the way, they want Assad and his inner circle out of power while maintaining in place large parts of his regime and the institutions of state. In other words, we think we learned something from Iraq where we destroyed everything and essentially broke the country and took them back into the Stone Age where it's now nothing but a terrorist hellhole. We did the same thing in Afghanistan. That doesn't work. So now what we want is just the leadership out, but leave everybody else. But everybody that's of any kind of a position of influence in Syria is Shia. And so what would you gain if you ousted Assad and his inner circle? You know, this idea we're going to demonize the country because of one man. No. It's the influence of the religion of Islam. If you replaced the emir in Saudi Arabia, or Kuwait, the king in Saudi Arabia, the king in Qatar, if you replaced all of the tyrants everywhere in the Islamic world, you said, you know, the tyrant and the dictator, the king, and his inner circle are all gone. We're going to leave the rest of the mechanism. There isn't one of those countries that would be materially better the following day. Not one. I mean, this is, again, this is so stupid that it hurts. And, of course, the Russians are not a friend here. You know, the Russians are on the side of Iran. The Russians' largest trading partner by far, I mean, by far, is Iran. They've signed $1 billion a month deal with Iran. And they've just signed a nuclear deal with Iran. Exactly what I've been predicting would happen for a long time now. And Iran is the primary beneficiary of Syria. Russia, Iran, Iran, Syria. There is 0% chance that the Russians are going to intervene on behalf of Saudi Arabia and Qatar against their ally, Iran, in Syria. Zero. It's their largest trading partner. Not going to happen, folks. Yeah. CNN is reporting that the Islamic State is planning to mint its own currency. But it's going to be real money. They're going to mint their currency in gold and silver. Real coins. Real value. Its aim is to stay away from the tyrant's financial system. You know, the tyrant's financial system is based on fiat concept, where money is a liability, it's not an asset. And so, to their credit, the Islamic State is going to mint currency in gold and silver. It's going to have real intrinsic value. The currency will include 7 coins, 2 gold, 3 silver, and 2 that are copper. The move is purely dedicated to Allah and will remove Muslims from the global economic system that is based upon satanic usury. Now, usury is a concept in Islam that it's not a, you know, it's an economic concept. It's charging undue interest. Muhammad had a problem with interest, which is why Islamic banks can't charge interest, which means there's no time value of money. And they come up with a fee system to replace the interest anyway. But the reality is that the reason Muhammad turned against interest is, A, he didn't understand the time value of money. He didn't understand the value of money, because if you steal something, you don't appreciate its value. If you have to work, for example, to buy the camel to ride, or in today's parlance, you have to work and have a job and save your money to go out and buy a car and maintain that car, then you're going to value the car. And you're going to value the medium that was used for you to buy the car and the work that you did to earn the money to buy the car. But if you're stealing the camel, and if you're enslaving others to take care of your camel, you have no value whatsoever in money. You have no value in work. You have no value in the camel. You stole it. It's the problem with the entitlement state that we've created in America. People don't value anything anymore because it's given to them. And it's really just political stealing when you take money from those who are productive and you choose to distribute it among those who want it. What's really the difference in that and armed robbery? I mean, without the police, without the military, those who are productive wouldn't relinquish their money. Without threat of imprisonment or death, they wouldn't relinquish their money to those who aren't productive. What's the difference in that and the armed robbery? But in either case, there's no appreciation of the value of the currency. There's no appreciation of the value of work. There's no appreciation of the value of the assets. So when Muhammad didn't work, and none of the Muslims in Yathrib worked, and that their only business was that of terrorism, which was stealing, pirating from the possessions of others, when the Jews loaned them money initially because they had no money for food, they had nothing. And the Jews loaned them money. They said, you know, you're pay us back the money, and of course there's some interest associated with it. Well, Muhammad was unwilling to pay them back the money, and he hated the idea that they were charging interest, that there was a time value associated with the money. And then the Jews began to sell Muhammad his Quran recitals, because they, and the Quran is full of these admonitions that the Jews actually sold Muhammad Talmud readings. And he never paid them for it. And so he came to hate money, hate interest. And that's why in Islam you can't charge interest. That's why these Muslims here are attacking usury. Usury has no influence in currency, whether that currency is gold or it's a fiat currency. The only place where interest is associated with a currency is that if you are inflating the amount of that currency at a time that you have borrowed money from someone, and let's say that you borrowed $100 from someone, and in circulation you had $1,000. But then you, before you pay them back, you create another $1,000. So now you have $2,000 in currency, and you pay them back $1,000. You've actually paid them back $100. You've now cheated them out of $100. So while there really is no connection between interest and currency, there is an interest consequence of fiat currencies, where governments have the propensity to increase the monetary supply. But nonetheless, here's the Islamic State creating their own currency, and it's going to be based on something real. This particular article says that unlike its predecessor, Al-Qaeda, and the predecessor of the Islamic State was absolutely not Al-Qaeda. So the person who is providing this quote is a nincompoop. There is no transition from Al-Qaeda to the Islamic State. They have always been foes, which raise money principally from internal sources. The Islamic State is principally, primarily self-funded, said Jimmy Gurule, who is a former Treasury Undersecretary and absolute ignoramus. That's what he told CNN's Lead with Jake Tapper on Thursday. Well, it's true that the Islamic State is self-funded. They're self-funded only in the sense, though, that they enslave little girls and sell them. They kidnap people and ransom them. Typical Islamic behaviors. Muhammad engaged in these same behaviors. They confiscate people's assets, like oil, and they sell that. They confiscate people's property that they have terrorized, and they sell that. Now, there is no industry being perpetrated in the Islamic State that makes them self-funded in the sense of an economic enterprise. No, it's all based on thievery. So if thievery is self-funding, then, Jimmy, you're a genius, at least with the second half of your statement. He said his funding comes from oil, ransom payments, taxes, and the sale of stolen artifacts. Even its taxes. Now, it does come from oil, but it's all stolen oil. They're not extracting oil and refining it. It's stolen oil. Ransom payments, of course, are for kidnapping. The sale of stolen property is, also not industry. But even its taxes. Its taxes are like the mafia. They're protection tax. You either pay the tax or we kill you. You pay the tax or we burn down your house. That kind of taxation endures a very short period of time where people finally say, yeah, I'd rather be dead. He goes on to say, this is the wealthiest terrorist organization that the world has ever known. Yes and no. I would say that the golden age of Islam, where Muslims in the first 100 years after Muhammad's death raided the world, that the wealthiest terrorist organization in the history of the world was Islam in its first 100 years. I don't think there's any question about that. And then the Ottoman Empire was largely funded via state-sponsored terrorism and terrorist raids as well. And so second only to the first 100 years, the golden age of Islam, where virtually every Muslim was a barbarian raider pirate, you'd have the Ottoman Empire. And they were much wealthier than the Islamic State. But it's just a pure terrorist state. And modern times, this is the wealthiest terrorist organization, certainly in the last 50 years. And it's the kind of money, it says here, that's hard to understand. It's actually just billions, maybe 10 billion. It's not that big a number. Reuters is reporting that according to the Obaminator and his inner circle, Iraq will need 80,000 effective military troops to retake terrain it lost to the Islamic State and to restore its border with Syria. This is now the top U.S. general. Now, I know for a fact that the United States, put in fancy uniforms, trained, and equipped almost a million Iraqis. Many, many hundreds of thousands of Iraqis were trained, were equipped, were paid by America. So if hundreds of thousands of Iraqis couldn't prevent the loss of territory with a very sparsely equipped Islamic State, how in the hell are 80,000 of them going to take back the territory they lost? Is this idiot with the Dempsey, Martin Dempsey, with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, is he so stupid that he thinks that 80,000 troops can take back what hundreds of thousands lost? That there somehow is going to be a difference between this 80,000 that's being trained now by 3,000 American advisors versus the hundreds of thousands that were trained by 100,000 U.S. troops? And that those troops that we trained and equipped over a period of 10 years who lost this territory will be somehow shown to be inferior to the 80,000 that we're going to train over these next few months. Are we crazy? I mean, if 800,000 lost the territory and we trained them for many years, how is 80,000 going to reclaim it now that the Islamic State is vastly better armed, having confiscated the equipment that we gave to the hundreds of thousand, and they're entrenched? I mean, well, he might as well have said 8,000 or 800,000. The numbers would be no more rational. Dempsey said a request for more U.S. forces in Iraq would create centers to help train the additional troops needed. I want to tell you, when you've had hundreds of thousands, nearly a million troops between the Iraqi security forces and the Iraqi military and the Shiite militias, when you've had a million trained troops under arms, and they surrendered the country's second largest city, and huge swaths of land representing half the country, that you aren't going to get it back with 80,000 of the same cadre of souls. News out of Nigeria is very bad. Boko Haram militants have seized the northeastern Nigerian town of Chibok. Chibok is the name of the town where the Islamic fundamentalist Islamic terrorist organization seized 250 schoolgirls, murdered some, tortured all of them, raped all of them. According to those, the two who actually survived and escaped, they were being raped by multiple men 15 times a day. And, of course, the world has done nothing to get them back. Well, today, rather than failing to get them back, something worse happened. And that is that Boko Haram went back into Chibok and took control of the town. You know, one time they went into the town, they killed the men, enslaved the children, and torched the place, and then camped out about, overnight, 5 miles away, where they began to rape the little girls that they had seized. And they continued to stay 5 to 10 miles outside of Chibok for a considerable period of time, raping these little girls. And no one did anything about it. No one even bothered to pursue them. And now they've come back into Chibok and just set up camp and said, it belongs to us. And the world yawns.